Hello, I'm David Eadie. This is number 0328, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0328. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet William Shun, who is the author of The Accidental Terrorist, Confessions of a Reluctant Missionary. It's a humorous true story of how, as a 19-year-old Mormon missionary visiting Canada, he ended up getting charged and thrown out of the country.
When I was about 4 months into my missionary service, I got really depressed. I wanted to go home, and I ran away. But they told my companion that he was in trouble for not doing everything in his power to keep me from leaving. A couple of months went by, and the shoe was on the other foot. I had a new companion who wanted to run away from his mission, and when he still wanted to leave, and I was unable to stop him in any other way, I finally resolved to stop his plane from leaving. I called the airline and said there was a bomb in a suitcase on that very flight.
Dr. Leslie Beth Wish is back on the show with some tips on how to avoid conflict during holiday family gatherings.
The first thing I recommend is don't plan to have one of those emotional powwows over the holidays where you think, oh my goodness, we're all together now, so this is a great time for me to tell Uncle Henry how much he hurt my feelings. You know, it starts out well. You say, Uncle Henry, I'm so glad you're here, but I really need to talk about, and then poor Uncle Henry is blindsided and his emotional defenses go way up, and pretty soon, in very, very short time, sometimes seconds or minutes, you're headed in the wrong direction.
Stuart Nolman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Nolman. Stuart Nolman. And Book Banter opens the case file on James Bond 007 in his new thriller, Trigger Mortis. So fire up the Aston Martin DB5 and have one shaken, not stirred. This case will be opened up very shortly on the Stuff File Program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0328 was David Eadie, a lifelong friend of mine and also a financial advisor with the Wealth Management Group. Thank you very much, David, for doing the guest slate on this program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Now, you know it's the holiday season, and the holiday season is filled with festive cheer, but in crime-ridden Detroit, it still isn't safe for Santa. So you better watch out, you better not cry, you better not fight, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is gunning you down. Not even jolly old St. Nick goes to Detroit without packing some heat. A festively dressed gunman, who is now in custody, told officers he felt threatened after arguing with a pair of men at a Detroit gas station early in the morning. So he shot them. An individual who was dressed as Santa and two other individuals got into some kind of confrontation, said Detroit police officer Adam Madeira. Two of the individuals went to their vehicle. They believed that Santa felt maybe they were going to get a weapon. He then shot these individuals. Then Santa took off on foot. Madeira said two off-duty officers in the area engaged in a short foot chase with the suspect and directed him to an on-duty officer who made the arrest. Detroit police officials confirmed that the two victims, both 29-year-old men, were recovering from gunshot wounds following the incident. Okay, by the way, you know, with the current climate in the U.S. concerning how some folks feel about law enforcement, could you imagine the PR nightmare if someone had their cell phone camera out taking footage of the cops chasing down Santa? Yeah. I don't see that going over too well, do you? And Christmas is, of course, just around the corner. And plus, our friends in the U.S. just celebrated Thanksgiving. And what is the Thanksgiving period without a turkey story or two to go with it? So here it is, albeit belated. And by the way, belated happy Thanksgiving to our American friends. I'm guessing turkeys are pretty stressed out, by the way, at this time of year. So let me share with you the story of one bird who tried a preemptive strike, a suicide mission, as it were. The turkey in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, launched a preemptive strike on Thanksgiving last week. Utility officials say the turkey flew into a power line in Sheboygan County, knocking out power to about 1,500 people. Well, to paraphrase WKRP in Cincinnati, as God is my witness, I thought turkeys couldn't fly. And here's another turkey story, this one from Gulf Breeze, Florida. Investigators there say a teenager and his friend used a bow and arrow to shoot and kill a neighbor family's pet turkey for their Thanksgiving dinner. Sheriff's deputies arrested the two Santa Rosa County teens, charging them with armed burglary, armed trespassing, theft of livestock, and animal cruelty. The teens told deputies they planned to eat the 30-pound turkey for Thanksgiving. The turkey's owners are a couple of animal lovers who live on 6 acres and have a multitude of animals, but they said this turkey was special because he was so friendly. In fact, they said he was more like a family dog than a turkey. Although, to be honest, I'm sure the family dog would not go nearly as well with stuffing, mashed potatoes, and gravy. 33-year-old Talloa Foster of Ada, Oklahoma, says she was driving down the road when one of her 3-year-old twin boys escaped his car seat. Now, while trying to deal with that, she told state troopers she fell out of the moving pickup truck. The boy grabbed the wheel and kept the truck on the road for 3 blocks before he finally swerved across all lanes of traffic and was stopped by the curb. So obviously it wasn't going that fast. Witnesses said as her pickup drove away, she simply walked after it. No one was injured, but troopers observed a nearly empty liquor bottle on the pickup's floor and charged Foster with driving under the influence of alcohol and child endangerment. Now, anybody care to state the obvious? I mean, she fell out of a moving vehicle. Sure, she was charged with driving under the influence and child endangerment, but isn't anybody going to tack on a seatbelt violation here? Yeah. Hazel Sycamore, a nurse in the Southland of New Zealand, was going to Uganda as a volunteer aid worker and anticipated a need there. Before she went, she put up signs at the local hospital that she was working at and also a breast care center where she works, asking for a specific donation. Within 3 weeks, I had about 400 bras, Sycamore said. They just kept coming in the door. She hauled them all to a Ugandan church for distribution. Many of the women there had to be shown how they were worn, but their delight was amazing. It was just so touching, Sycamore said. Well, there you go. Now, that's an uplifting story. About 200 customers were affected by a power outage in Portland, Oregon. The cause of the blackout, 2 indoor marijuana growing operations that overloaded a transformer. Portland General Electric spokesman Steve Corson said the company estimates about 10% of the 400 transformers it replaces per year are overheated from people growing marijuana. It's common to see 1,000-watt bulbs in a marijuana grow, said Corson. The state allows up to 4 pot plants to be grown per residence. PGE spokesman Tom Gaunt said a 4-plant operation draws the same amount of power as 29 refrigerators. The latest outage was one of 7 caused by grows in the area. 7's not a lot, Gaunt said, but we want to nip this in the bud. Well, you know, just on the munchies factor alone, anyone consuming 4 plants would need 27 refrigerators anyway. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, officials at Dunbar West Virginia Middle School buzzed in a man who came to the door. The morning announcements were being read over the school PA system, and the man demanded the microphone. He said he wanted to sing Justin Bieber songs to the students. The school called police and went into lockdown, and Dileonte D. Lewis was handcuffed and taken to a South Charleston hospital for observation. He was also cited for marijuana possession. When released, Lewis went to Kitty College Daycare in South Charleston and told officials there that he wanted to speak to the children as Justin Bieber and stated that he could see them because he was Jesus. the resulting criminal complaint alleges. Now, Lewis was arrested and charged with disorderly conduct and trespassing. So, basically, he tried to sing Justin Bieber songs and is now going to jail. You know, this could start a trend. I'm just saying. Anyway, let's get to our first guest, shall we? If your only experience with the Mormon Church is when they ring your doorbell, or perhaps you've seen a Road Company version of the Book of Mormon, then our next guest has a book you should read. It's called The Accidental Terrorist, Confessions of a Reluctant Missionary, which chronicles the true story of his service as a Mormon missionary and the events that led to his arrest and conviction on terrorism-related charges. The author is William Shun, and he joins us now via Skype from Queens, New York. Hi, William.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So, I don't get to talk to terrorists often, by the way.
Me neither, thank goodness.
Okay. Your story is a rather interesting one in that back in 1987, you actually got in a little trouble here in this country. As a matter of fact, you're not allowed in Canada, are you?
No, I have not been back to Canada since 1987 for that very reason.
Okay. But it is a serious issue, but not as serious as one might think if they hear all the details. But you've written about it in your book, The Accidental Terrorist. Tell us about the story.
Well, it tells the story of my service as a Mormon missionary in the late 80s. When you're a missionary, you have a companion with you, an assigned partner, who is really with you at all times. You knock on doors together, you study together in the morning, you live together in the same apartment. And when I was about 4 months into my missionary service, I got really depressed. I wanted to go home, and I ran away. I made it from Brooks, Alberta, as far as Great Falls, Montana, before the church leaders caught up with me and convinced me to go back. But they told my companion that he was in trouble for not doing everything in his power to keep me from leaving. And that was a lesson that stuck with me. So when a couple of months went by and the shoe was on the other foot, I had a new companion who wanted to run away from his mission. I tried talking him out of it. And when he still wanted to leave and I was unable to stop him in any other way, I finally resolved to stop his plane from leaving.
And you did this by?
I called the airline and said there was a bomb in a suitcase on that very flight.
And again, we should emphasize, you were 19.
I was 19. This was not a good idea, as became clear even to this 19-year-old brain very quickly. I was at the airport. I could see men walking around with walkie-talkies very intently, moving from one place to another, and I realized that I had just made an incredible mistake. And as I went to talk to various customs people to kind of clear things up and help to try to get in touch with the missionary who was trying to leave, they put it together pretty quickly that I was the fellow who had called in the bomb threat, and I was arrested within less than an hour of making the phone call.
Now, I understand you paid a fine. You had, I think, a sentence of just basically one day, which is your day in court. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And then they escorted you out of the country, basically.
Essentially, yes. Okay. As soon as I was convicted of public mischief, which is the charge that eventually stuck, then I was called in front of an immigration inquiry with Canada Immigration, and they made the determination that I was no longer eligible to stay in the country.
Now, as a Canadian, I have to ask the question, this desire to escape, was it the desire to escape the Mormon Church or just Calgary?
No, it was a desire to escape specifically my service to the Mormon Church. I did not have in mind yet that I was going to leave the Mormon Church, but I really didn't want to be a missionary. Canada, Calgary had nothing to do with it.
Okay, now you're an author, you're a writer of well renown. You've been nominated for many awards. You've done a lot of writing, obviously. You've made a career out of this. But this story, as I said, happened in 1987. Why are you writing about it now?
Well, really, I've I've actually written bits and pieces of this story all along. It's seen a few different forms over the years. I originally wrote it as a series of postings on a chat board called Genie way back in the early 90s. And then when the web started catching on, I posted those little snippets on my website in 1995. And the story became somewhat infamous in Mormon and ex-Mormon circles. And I always had it in mind to turn the story into a real book, because I wanted to write not just about that incident and try to explain what was going through my head that would actually bring me to the point of making a bomb threat. But I really wanted to write a book examining and explaining what the lives of Mormon missionaries really are like. And I went through many, many drafts over the years. The first draft was finished in 2001, which was really kind of an unfortunate time, especially in New York, to be writing a book that was about an act of terrorism. September 11th kind of made it very hard to market my manuscript. And so it stayed in a drawer for a while, and I would take it out every few years and polish it up.
And especially, I guess, we should emphasize the fact that your book contains a lot of humor, right?
Yes,
Which at that time probably would not have gone over big with the subject matter involved.
It was not the time for a book with that sort of a tone.
Yeah. Now, so who's a bigger target to the Mormon Church now? Would it be you or Trey Parker and Matt Stone?
Oh, I'm sure Trey Parker and Matt Stone are a much bigger target. The Mormon Church keeps taking out advertisements and giant billboards near where the Book of Mormon, the musical, is playing in Times Square. They're always putting ads in playbills at that play. I don't think they're going to really bother doing any counter-advertising to me.
Mm. Have you heard from the powers that be within the Mormon Church? I'm assuming they know about the stories you've written and the book now, The Accidental Terrorist.
Well, I've done my best to bring it to their attention. I haven't actually attended a Mormon church in about 20 years, but I sent copies to the local church leaders here in Queens a couple of months ago. And in fact, I just mailed my resignation letter into the Mormon Church about a week ago, and got back an official confirmation that my resignation had been received and my name was taken off the rolls.
Mm. Now, what about your family? I know you come from a relatively large family. Well, you're a Mormon, so you come from a relatively large family. I would assume most of them, if not all of them, are still Mormons.
Actually, in my family, I'm the oldest of eight children. And four of us have left the church out of those eight. So my parents, really, they're batting 500. Their batting average is not good for a Mormon family. I'll put it that way.
Mm. So seriously, what do your parents say about this? Again, you write this book. A lot of it is done with humor. It shares your story. So what do your parents say?
Well, my father passed away a few years ago, so he didn't actually get to see this version of the book. He was never a believer in me telling this story. He would have preferred me just to keep quiet about any trouble with the law. My mother does not really talk to me about it. We have a good relationship, but we just really don't talk about how she feels about my book. Mm-hmm. I have siblings, though, who really love it.
On which side of the Mormon fence are they?
on the ex-Mormon side of the fence.
On the ex-Mormon side.
Yes.
Well, again, you were writing this book back when 9/11 happened, and we're talking about it now in 2015, but of course, as we just recently seen, terrorism is once again rearing its ugly head.
Right.
So there's the cloud of that's out there. And you have some competition in the book world from another book dealing with another religion much in the same way, and that's Leah Remini's book.
Oh, I have not read this.
Leah Remini's book, which is Troublemaker, Surviving Hollywood and Scientology. So her book is out, and she's getting a lot of buzz, and there seems to be a growing pattern of people leaving various organized religions and writing about it, in some cases, very humorously.
Yeah, I think humor is really the best way you can respond to having gone through some extreme religious experiences like this, and I'm sure like Scientology is. I think that when you're telling a message of why you don't believe in something, and sort of pitching it to people who might might still be adherents of the faith, humor is a really good way to go, to sneak under their defenses and kind of disarm them so that they'll maybe pay a little bit more attention to what you're talking about.
You've written about this again over a series of years, but now you've got this book out. Putting this book together in the form that it is now, was it a cathartic experience for you?
It was, absolutely, absolutely. It was very cathartic to finally have the book done and out there after so many years. But the process of going through, especially the last two drafts of this book, was remarkably cathartic. I really had to dig into a lot of past feelings and try to understand and put myself back in the shoes of that young missionary, and really try to remember where my head was at the time, what kinds of things I was feeling, and what was really driving me. And I think that really ultimately made it a better book. But I really got in touch with a lot of things that I had forgotten, a lot of feelings and a lot of sort of the expectations I had as a teenager. It was a really good experience for me.
You're no longer a member of the Mormon Church. Are you still religious, though?
No, I'm not religious in the least. I call myself an atheist these days.
The book is called The Accidental Terrorist: Confessions of a Reluctant Missionary. I'm sure the book will do very well.
From your mouth to whatever's
there. And I thank you very, very much for being on the program. People can find more information by going to your website, which is shun.net, and that's shunn.net, correct?
Correct.
Thank you very much for being on the program with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
William Shun, author of The Accidental Terrorist, Confessions of a Reluctant Missionary. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0328, and you'll find links to William's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about avoiding confrontation during the holiday period at family gatherings. Plus, Stuart Nullman is along with another edition of Book Banter. And we have more Stuff File news to get to through the course of this program, of course. And, of course, an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on. All this coming on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. But right now, we got more Stuff File news right here, right now. Move over, Luke Skywalker. Darth Vader has a new nemesis, salad dressing. Police in Florida say the force was not with a Darth Vader wannabe, who was pelted with a jar of salad dressing during an alleged robbery attempt. Investigators said a man dressed as the Star Wars villain and armed with a silver handgun entered the 8 till late convenience store in Jacksonville Beach at around 5:30 p.m. and demanded cash from the store clerk. Police said the clerk answered the Sith Lord's request by struggling with him and throwing a jar of blue cheese salad dressing, which struck the alleged robber in the helmet. The suspect fled, but witnesses outside the store got a quick glimpse of his face when he took off his helmet before driving away. The vehicle was located after an investigation, and its owner, 32-year-old Jacob Jeremy Mercer of Tonawanda, New York, was located at a residence and arrested. Mercer, who was bleeding from the bridge of his nose, was identified by a witness as the man in the Darth Vader costume. Police said Mercer had several handguns and ammunition in a backpack. Mercer was charged with armed robbery and possession of a firearm by a felon. Well, the force is not strong in this one, is it? And a Georgia man was injured and arrested while attempting to steal a beer truck from a local gas station. 55-year-old Gregory Miller. Wouldn't it be something if his name was Bud Miller? Anyway, Miller was apprehended after attempting to steal a Coors Light delivery truck from a Circle K gas station in Columbus, Georgia, at around 6 a.m. Miller drove the vehicle to a Bojangles restaurant where he pulled the truck over but failed to put on the parking brake, leading the truck to drive over his leg. After being brought into custody, Miller was taken to Midtown Medical Center with a severe ankle injury. When Miller is released from the hospital, he will face charges of theft by taking a motor vehicle and eluding police. I think it's also going to be a while before he gets a chance to have another beer. And 25-year-old John Wesley Rose went to the Wayne County, Michigan Sheriff's Office hoping for a job as an officer starting at the jail. Once they did a background check, they were only too pleased to put him in uniform and in jail. "We contacted him and said, 'We've been looking at your application,' said the chief of the sheriff's department. 'We need you to come in to take one final test, and we'll be happy to hire you.' Rose quickly reported in and was very quickly placed in handcuffs. The department had discovered that there was a warrant out for his arrest in Kentucky, accusing him with sex crimes involving a teenager. Well, he wanted to turn himself into a cop, but instead he turned himself into a cop. Over the years, if I had a nickel for every potential police applicant whose career was thwarted by their own record, wow, I could buy a Ford automobile in 1928. Meanwhile, the manager of an agency in Louisville, Kentucky, responsible for, among other things, development planning, zoning changes, and historic landmarks, revealed in November that his headquarters has a boogers problem and ordered users of the third floor men's room to stop hawking them onto the walls adjacent to the urinals. According to an internal memo cited by InsiderLouisville.com, Metro Planning and Design Services Manager Joe Reverman called the mucus buildup a very serious situation and had his executive administrator post signs instructing restroom users on the basics of proper disposal of anything that comes out of or off of a person's body. In other words, it's snot hygienic. Snot hygienic. See what I did there? Yeah. Okay, what passes for great and valuable art these days? Well, let's share a couple of examples. Number one, the 1968 Cy Twombly blackboard painting sold for $70.5 million at New York City's Sotheby's auction in November, and that's higher than experts estimated, which was about $60 million they thought it would pull in. The painting consists of six horizontal lines of continuous circular swirls, white chalk on a blackboard, perhaps the same swirls that might be made by an extremely bored, aggressive first grader given a supply of chalk and the absence of a teacher. $70.5 million. Someone out there has more dollars than cents. And number two, the Baltimore-based experimental music creators Matmos announced their release of their new album, Ultimate Care 2, consisting entirely of music made by a Whirlpool washing machine, the Ultimate Care 2 model. According to a November report in Time magazine, the machine's 38-minute wash cycle will be sampled and processed to lighten the original sound. Matmos previously played canisters of helium on stage at Radio City Music Hall and a cow's uterus at the San Francisco Art Institute. I'm just going to leave that last one alone. And, oh, they should, I think, have a follow-up to their washing machine album with maybe a dishwasher album. Now, that's a beat you can dance to. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the exasperated drug enforcement chief of Indonesia told reporters in November, following confiscation of a massive quantity of methamphetamine from China, that the ordinary death penalty was insufficient for drug runners who should instead be forced to overdose on their own shipments. Budi Waseso also mused that crocodiles would make better prison guards than humans because crocs can't be bribed, and later added tigers and piranhas to the proposed guard roster. Even so, Waseso's bosses reiterated that the government is committed to rehabilitation over punishment. Wow, crocodile, tiger, and piranha guards. You know, this guy seems to have the elaborate Rube Goldberg thought process of a Bond villain. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest, shall we? Our friends in the U.S. have just celebrated Thanksgiving, which is the kickoff to the holiday period, a time when families get together. Christmas is coming up next. Are you upset with your family? Think it's time to get some things off your chest? Psychotherapist Leslie Beth Wish says this might not be the best time to clear the air. She has some tips to help put things in perspective and avoid a holiday blow-up. Leslie Beth Wish is the author of Smart Relationships, How Successful Women Can Find True Love. She joins us once again on the line from Florida. Hi, Dr. Leslie Beth.
Hi, how are you? And thank you for having me, and happy holidays to everyone.
Happy holidays to you, too. Thanks for being on the program with us once again. So it's a time when people get together, and we always talk about the love and the friendship and the coming together of families. But it's also, for a lot of people, a time for of stress because there are conflicts within families. So how does one manage the familial minefield that are the holiday period?
Very difficult. The first thing I recommend is don't plan to have one of those emotional powwows over the holidays where you think, oh my goodness, we're all together now, so this is a great time for me to tell Uncle Henry how much he hurt my feelings. You know, it starts out well. You say, Uncle Henry, I'm so glad you're here, but I really need to talk about. And then poor Uncle Henry is blindsided, and his emotional defenses go way up. And pretty soon, in very, very short time, sometimes seconds or minutes, you're headed in the wrong direction.
Okay, so you don't want to do this. The other side of that coin, of course, is it's the only time when everybody's together. So if you don't do it then, when do you do it?
Well, and that's one of the biggest mistakes that people make. They think this is their only opportunity, but it isn't. One of the things you want to do is start laying the groundwork ahead of time of creating a positive view of you. Instead of looking at the holiday get-togethers as a time to mend fences with everybody, look at it as a time to change their impression of you.
And it's interesting you say that, because don't we do some inadvertent role playing when we get together with family? Even if we don't want to, I mean, we move away and move apart from our families and develop our own personalities to who we are today. Yet when we get back into the family structure, especially if it's a large family, you might be the youngest of five or the middle child or whatever, and you seem to revert back to whatever situations you were living in when you were kids. Is that part of the problem?
Always part of the problem. Think of your family as having the power of kryptonite. Here you are, Supergirl or Superboy or Superman in your current life, and you go home and boy, you just get weakened. You become the stupid one, the smart aleck one, the problem one, the favorite one, the least favorite one, the one everybody says, when are you going to get married, or you got problems with those kids again. You can almost predict what each of these family members is going to do and how you are going to feel. But I have tips as how to change that.
Okay, so how do you change it?
Okay, first of all, think about yourself. You would never want to be blindsided by someone pulling you aside and saying, I need to talk to you about the time 20 years ago when you said, I mean, you don't like that. So what I recommend you do is start now. It's not too late. Start now by sending text messages, emails, or actual snail mail, whatever works for that person, a nice card. Looking forward to seeing you. I'd like to hear more about, and then fill in the blank, your new home, your new baby, your job, your retirement, or I would like your advice on, you know, fill in the blank. Lay the groundwork now, especially if you are a family member who has often been the least favorite one or the problem one. So that's the first step. The second thing you might want to do is when you get there, you might want to, and this takes some boldness, you might want to stand up and make a toast. You might want to go around the room and say something nice to everyone either in the room or around the table. And then you want to say, I want you to know that wayward Stephen or unhappy Irene no longer exists, and you're talking about yourself. I have now made some important changes in my life, and I know that you'd be happy to know this. So what you're doing is slowly changing their perception of you, because the whole family kind of has like one mindset about you, and you want to slowly change that mindset.
Excellent.
And the third thing you want to do is how to deal with those people who create the most problems. The one who say, you still have that dumb job you've got, you know, there's always someone in the family, right, who your heart just begins to get pounding. Oh, my God, you get defensive already. So what you want to do is one-to-one or in the group, and you have to use your judgment on this, you might want to say to Uncle Henry again, who's always picking on you, you might want to say, Uncle Henry, you've asked me the most questions about my, you know, fill in the blank, my job, my drug problem, whatever it is. And I've realized I've never asked you for advice on what to do. And what this does is it really puts that hot potato right back in that person's lap. And you would be amazed at how little advice these people have to say to you.
Wow. Those are all great points, but what about the other fly in the ointment? And that is, I don't want to say the term outsider, but let's say the late arrival to the family who is well-meaning. And I'll give you a for instance. Let's say for argument's sake, and I'm single, but let's say I'm married, I have a wife and kids, and I'm going to the family get-together, and there's a little bit of angst for me, because I know I'm going to have to deal and revert back into the old familial situations, but I'm willing to move past it and keep my mouth shut and not pop off when something goes wrong. However, I have told all these stories to my spouse, who obviously wants to support me, and while I go there and sit down and put up with whatever Uncle Henry says, she might want to chime in to defend me. You know what I mean?
Yes, and you do not want your best friend, spouse, or partner to do your dirty work. But they can do things behind the scenes. Let's say that you are the least favorite, least regarded kid in the family, and you just can't stand that. So what you said is so important. Number one, recognize what traps you usually fall into. And you already talked about, you know, oh my gosh, these are the old roles I get stuck in. Secondly, what outcome would you like? Because instead of, you know, going backwards and digging up the past, play it forward. What outcome would I like, and how would I like that to happen? And often the outcome that people want is a more positive family view of you. So that's why I like the idea of sending the cards ahead of time, thanking everybody, making an announcement as to how you've changed. But other things you can do is with your partner or spouse is, you know, as they walk around the room, they can say, boy, you can't believe how wonderful so-and-so has been. He's really changed in these ways. Just to kind of drop the little hints and be, you know, your roving cheerleading section.
But
those are very important.
Is it also important to have a game, like you say, you seem to have a game plan with your spouse before you get there? Is it also a good idea to say, look, honey, no matter what happens, I can handle the situation. Don't defend me, because that's only going to escalate the situation.
Yes, don't ask your partner to fight your battles, but I do like the idea of recruiting them as their roving cheerleader, and absolutely what you're saying is spot on. Go with a plan. Know who those people are. Know how you tend to react to them. What is your goal? Don't wallow in, oh my God, what I did last year, and I don't hope, you know, Uncle Henry and Aunt Susan don't act like they do. Don't do that. Play it forward. How can I change their perception of me? How can I, as you say, not say something, hold my tongue, because it'll just get me into trouble? Put it this way. Once those little talking words are out there, you can't take them back, but you can always add a conversation later.
And very quickly, do we sometimes put too much importance about what is said or not said, or a glance or a look? Do we sometimes read too much into the body language and or words that people closest in our lives that we grew up with might use, because we know what inference it is, but maybe they're not seeing it that way? In other words, Uncle Henry might be saying things, but he doesn't have a mean bone in his body. He just doesn't see how it affects you.
That's possible, and I would add to that that perhaps Uncle Henry is responding to the old you, because you haven't taken responsibility for announcing the new you. The other thing is, when a person in your family who has power over you, like your older sibling or your twin or your father or your grandfather, whatever, when they say something, a certain tone or a certain look, it doesn't take much to trip off your old family feelings.
Good information indeed. And again, it's always a great time to have you on the program. I should mention your book one more time. It's Smart Relationships, How Successful Women Can Find True Love. People can also find out more information by going to your website, which is lovevictory.com. Dr. Leslie Beth Wish, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us. And again, happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you. And it's always a pleasure to work with you.
Dr. Leslie Beth Wish, author of Smart Relationships, How Successful Women Can Find True Love. You can go to my website at thestuffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0328, and you'll find links to Leslie Beth's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. In basketball, a player who commits too many fouls is ejected from the game. In our court system, a person who files too many frivolous lawsuits can be ejected from the courts, too. There's a legal term for a person who files too many frivolous lawsuits. They're called a vexatious litigant. Courts don't do this often, but a woman in Idaho filed so many frivolous lawsuits she was officially named a vexatious litigant by 3 states, 2 federal circuit courts, and the U.S. Supreme Court. The courts told the repeat lawsuit offender that she couldn't file any more lawsuits without special permission from a judge. So what did she do next? She actually sued the last judge who told her she couldn't file any more lawsuits. Let's be fair. Taking away anyone's right to sue should be done only as a last resort. Yet because frivolous lawsuits tie up courts and delay justice for others, judges shouldn't hesitate to penalize people when they continuously abuse the courts. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And we do have indeed, once again, Stuart Nauman, shaken, not stirred. Hello, sir.
Hello, Peter. I see you've tried out my Aston Martin DB5 with modifications.
Yes, a few. I don't sit in the passenger side, by the way.
No, because I only suggest, you know, for friends, I let them drive it.
Okay, okay.
You know. For people who are not exactly my friends, you know, take a, you know, passenger side as always. And then I say, I have a little surprise and, you know.
Buckle up.
Buckle up.
I think people now can guess what we're about to talk about.
I hope so, because in this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at the new novel about James Bond. Because Bond is back, folks. You know, for fans of the suave secret agent 007 of the British Secret Service with the License to Kill, those three words mean so much to them this year. You know, with the release of Spectre on screen, and it's been breaking box office records everywhere. And for those who appreciate James Bond's literary origins, they'll certainly enjoy the latest page-turning adventure by British author Anthony Horowitz. It's called Trigger Mortis. Trigger Mortis. The story takes place in 1957, and Bond has just completed his latest MI6 assignment against one of his greatest archenemies, or Goldfinger. And just as things were getting ordinary in Harold Macmillan 1950s London, Bond gets another exciting assignment from M. This time he's assigned to protect Landy Smith, the British champion Grand Prix race car driver, whose life is being threatened by a rival Russian racer who is connected with Smirsch, the deadly Soviet espionage agency that is Bond's original nemesis during those pre-Spectre days. And this automotive assassination is targeted to take place at this West German racetrack called Nürburgring, which is regarded in reality as one of the most dangerous tracks on the F1 circuit. So Bond encounters at the post-race party this Sin Jae Song, who's known as Jason Sin. He's a humorless, soulless South Korean tycoon whose early life was filled with tragedy, especially during the Japanese occupation of Korea and the Korean War. And he finds out that Sin's nefarious plot, he wants to infiltrate the U.S. military's testing of their Vanguard rockets, explode a rocket over New York City during one of these tests, employing a toggle switch at mission control that immediately self-destructs the rocket and aborts the mission, which is called the Trigger Mortis, which would cause a high amount of human casualties and damage to the city, and in turn this will create pressure on the U.S. government to abandon their rocket testing program and therefore open the door for the Russians to win the space race during its early years.
Hmm.
You know, just right after Sputnik. So it's up to Bond and his newfound cohort Jeopardy Lane, a tough female CIA agent, to foil Jason Sin's violent domination plot and avert the Russians' conquest of outer space. Now, what makes Trigger Mortis stand out from the rest of the post-Ian Fleming 007 novels is that Horowitz got that rare privilege from the Ian Fleming estate and integrated some original material that was written by Fleming but was never before published for the public to read, which was actually written during the late 50s as treatments for a proposed James Bond TV series that never materialized. And if you don't read Horowitz's explanation behind the use of the newly discovered Fleming material, which is detailed in the acknowledgement section in the book, at the end of the book, actually, you wouldn't be able to tell what was written by Horowitz recently or by Fleming nearly 60 years ago.
Wow.
So although the plot of the book subtly utilizes elements of the movie versions of Dr. No, You Only Live Twice and Octopussy, there's still plenty to enjoy in Trigger Mortis, especially the terrifying F1 race at Nürburgring, Bond's harrowing escape from being buried alive by Jason Sin, and Jason Sin's use of the Hanafuda playing cards, which determines by the luck of the draw how violent an end his enemies will go through.
Now, so, I'm just curious. You've explained, considering that Ian Fleming's hand is in this book, literally, explained why it goes back to 1957. But generally speaking, I know you're a Bond fan, as am I. How do you feel about the idea of literally a retro Bond, going back in time to the days of the Cold War?
Well, I mean, it's I think it's a good way of, I mean, past Bond reincarnation, so to speak, have, you know, some have, you know, had Bond, you know, in today's world, some of Bond during the 60s and some during the 50s. And I think it's a good way of just giving people who are, you know, recent converts to James Bond in the movies, and no doubt it was based on a book by Ian Fleming or based on creations by Ian Fleming, that it sort of gives you a sense of Bond's literary roots.
Right.
Actually. So maybe that will spark interest in people in reading the actual Ian Fleming works.
Which are great, by the way. I love them all.
Oh,
well, I lie. I love them all except one.
Well, I wonder which one. I don't think it, probably one of the later ones, I guess.
I think The Spy Who Loved Me is a book that I only read because I felt compelled to read them all. And I was cursing through every blessed page of that book, waiting for it to get to the end. I hated it.
Yeah, it's like, and that's the only time that Montreal's mentioned in the book.
And the only one that's written in first person from another character's perspective, which there's just so many plot holes in that book that just annoyed me that it's like, but don't get me started. Don't get me started.
Okay.
I'm in my good Bond place here right now. Don't get me started.
It's like, all right, so where's Anya Amosova? Okay. But Trigger Mortis is a Bond novel that will satisfy, you know, the Secret Agent's many fans as a throwback, as I said before, to the original spirit of Ian Fleming novels during its golden age nearly 60 years ago. And after a breathless read where 007 once again saves the world from the twisted ambitions of a madman, we can happily close the book and think to ourselves, James Bond will return.
Excellent. So the book is called?
It's called Trigger Mortis by Anthony Horowitz, published by HarperCollins, and it's $33.99.
And dare I say, what do you recommend in a similar vein? Because if you're talking Bond, there's so much to choose from.
Well, I say if you're going to read this book, Trigger Mortis, I suggest you read the original Goldfinger novel, which was published in 1959. Read that. And also, just for a little different twist, try these two books by John Pearson. One is called James Bond, The Authorized Biography, which is gives you a sense of James Bond's past, his actual life, so to speak. It's sort of like a biographical novel. It's really good, actually. And also by John Pearson, an actual factual book, The Life of Ian Fleming, which was published in 1966-67, and is for many years was considered the definitive work on the life of Ian Fleming.
And let me toss in one book out there that is a Bond book not written by Ian Fleming. It was post his death, and that is Colonel Sun.
Oh, yeah, by Robert Markham.
Yes, or Kingsley Amis, depending which title name you'd like to use. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed that, actually. And I've read some of Robert Benson's books, too. But Sun caught me off guard because maybe I had low expectations. And I was actually surprised at how good it was, from my perspective.
And I think the recent rash of Bond novelists who's picked up the golden pen from Ian Fleming, are getting more and more cooperation from his estate, or approval from his estate to write these books. So that, which is pretty good, actually. I think that's a very good affirmation that people still want to read about James Bond's adventures, as well as seeing them on the big screen.
Yeah. So again, the latest book is
Trigger Mortis by Anthony Horowitz. It's published by HarperCollins, $33.99.
And how can people find you, sir?
Well, they won't find me at Universal Export, that's for sure. They'll find me in the Montreal Times, not the Times of London, in print, or online, www.mtltimes.ca.
Excellent. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you there, Peter. You expect me to talk, Goldfinger?
No, I expect you to die. Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Bander here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about into the home stretch here on The Stuff File program, a program that's also heard, I think I've mentioned it once or twice, on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Have I mentioned that? I think I have. Anyway, that one item to go, you know what it is, boys and girls. It's the last thing we always have on the program. It's time once again for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I present, the Idiot of the Day.
Okay, selecting this week's item was a slightly tough decision. I mean, I was torn between the idea of making him the idiot of the day or using the item as a Darwin file story, so there you go. You already know how this turned out. But in the end, idiocy wins out. 25-year-old Caleb Alexander was shot and killed in October as he emerged from a United Dairy Farmers convenience store in Columbus, Ohio, still with his gun defiantly drawn after he had just then robbed the clerk. A Columbus police SWAT team was waiting outside the store because Alexander had robbed the store the previous two nights as well, and somehow must have thought that the police would not catch on to his cunning robbery strategy. Now why, oh why, would someone committing armed robberies rob the same location at the same time 3 days in a row? One reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot! A dead idiot, but an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0328. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and that's 0328. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air online or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Experienced another edition of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Now, doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? Like watching puppies and kittens frolicking in a field of daisies. Like the smells coming from Grandma's kitchen. Like the hallucinogenics you took in the 60s and I'm taking right now. Hello, cartoon birdies. Perhaps I've said too much. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let the glow wash over you and enjoy. Peace out.